Welcome to the Activist Files, the Center for Constitutional Rights podcast, where we feature the stories of activists, lawyers, and storytellers on the front lines, fighting for justice and liberation. If you want to know more about the Center for Constitutional Rights and our work, visit our website at ccrjustice.org. You can sign up for our weekly newsletter, Frontlines of Justice, and we'll keep you up to date on important developments and exciting events near you or online. You can also make a donation to help us keep doing the vital work of supporting our partners, movements, and communities. As always, don't forget to subscribe to the Activist Files and rate us on iTunes, Spotify, and SoundCloud. And now, here's the Activist Files podcast.
In this episode of the Activist Files, we'll hear a discussion sparked by the 10th anniversary of the historic ruling in our Stop and Frisk case, Floyd v. City of New York. The Center for Constitutional Rights, together with NYU Review of Law and Social Change, NYU's Ending the Prison Industry Complex, and NYU's National Law Guild chapter, brought together law students, lawyers, organizers, and impacted community members for a one-day symposium back on November 3, 2023. Together, we reflected on lessons learned in the last decade of struggle for police reform and accountability and imagined a future of abolition and community safety. What you will hear is the first panel of the day, 10 years since Floyd. The panelists were activist and organizer Joo-Hyun Kang, who formerly headed the coalition Communities United for Police Reform, Floyd plaintiff David Auerlicht, and Floyd counsel Darius Charney, now the director of the Racial Profiling and Biased Policing Investigations Unit at the New York City Civilian Complaint Review Board, also known as the CCRB. Our own advocacy director, Nadia Ben Youssef, moderated. We hope you'll be as inspired as we were.
First, I'm going to just start by asking you each to introduce yourselves and to situate yourself in this story. So again, we're 10 years since Floyd and this sort of long struggle to end racist policing in New York City. So who are you? Situate yourself in this story. And what does this work mean to you? So we'll start with you, David.
At the time or now?
Now. Who are you? And I mean, you can also say at the time, too, because that's important.
Same person. I think I've always been the same person. David Auerlicht, born and raised here in New York City. You know, I think my parents walked here. Was a named plaintiff on the Floyd case, signed up in 2008, yeah, that around that time, after multiple stops that I ended up testifying to in federal court. And after that, pursued a career in law and became public defender. For the last 6 years, I've been public defender at the Legal Aid Society, and I recently left. Earlier this year.
I love that. Joo-Hyun Kang, I'm no longer on staff with the Communities United for Police Reform, but Alan Abraham is here, who is on staff, and he is fabulous, and so are other folks who are on staff there at CPR. I entered the story probably in the 1900s, funnily enough.
20th century.
When Richie Perez-Lahr talked about earlier, who was a founder of the National Congress for Puerto Rican Rights, and Monifa's organization, Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. Monifa also dates back to the 1900s. And other groups had formed a coalition in New York City, a small grassroots coalition called Coalition Against Police Brutality, which included Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, the Justice Committee, which was then actually the chapter of the National Congress of Puerto Rican Rights in New York City, the Audre Lorde Project, which is where I was, which is a queer and trans people of color organizing center, and other CAV organizing Asian communities, and then a variety of different youth organizations at different times. And the reason why I raise that is because when the coalition had started in 1996, there was significant work that we did that was primarily direct action. So a lot of civil disobedience, a lot of other kind of organizing, but with direct action at its core. And Richie, who was part of the coalition through the National Congress, came to us one day, and all of us were in our teens or 20s, and so don't try to do the math. Whatever, I'm older. But at that point, Richie came to us at a meeting and was like, look, it's all great that we're doing all this direct action, but we've got to use other tactics. And after the murder of Diallo, he was like, we should go to this legal group. None of us knew who he was talking about, but the Center for Constitutional Rights. And not because CCR wasn't famous, it's because of our limited knowledge, maybe my limited knowledge. And we should ask them to help do a lawsuit around this, because for years, since 1996, when the CAPI had been founded, one of the core areas of police abuse that we were dealing with was stops, not only of Black and Latinx young people, but also Arab young people, Southeast Asian young people, vendors, other folks across the city. And the other piece that was very prominent in CAPI's work at the time was really working to support the families of loved ones who were killed by police. Families like Mother Anthony Baez and numerous others. The reason I name both of those is because one of the things Richie really trained us in is to understand that the high-profile police killings are really the tip of the iceberg. The iceberg is allowed because there are all of these daily interactions with police that are violent, humiliating, unnecessary, and do not make us safe. And that if we don't deal with the actual iceberg, the daily occurrences, which in that period was a lot of stops, especially of young people of color and trans women of color, other folks, immigrants, et cetera, that we would never be able to stop and prevent police killings. So I'm going to stop there, but some of the history, I just want to bring folks like Richie, the Justice Committee, and Malcolm X grassroots movement into the room.
Darius Charney, former CCR attorney, and now, as Jihyun pointed out, I just changed the name of my organization, added one letter, and now it's CCRB, so I really like that CCR. I got a lot of my team here today, so thank you guys for coming. And I joined the story, I guess, about 9 years in. Well, actually, more than that, because, I mean, this really goes back to the mid-90s at least, but I joined CCR 2008. I think I started... My first day was like literally 2 weeks before Floyd got filed. I still remember very clearly going down to the, because back then you had to go file your case like by hand. They had an electronic system, but the complaint filing was still by hand. So going with my colleagues down to the courthouse in over on Pearl Street, filing the case, and then immediately going upstairs to Judge Shinlin's chambers because we had to bring an order to show cause, which is like an emergency motion. And those of you who both litigate against the NYPD and also for my colleagues who have to try to get documents and information from the NYPD, you'll appreciate this. The reason we had to do that, ridiculous. So Bahar mentioned, you know, from the Daniels settlement, how CCR had gotten a bunch of data on the stop and frisk activity. And so obviously we were using that data in the Floyd case, or we're going to use it, had already used it in the complaint. But the NYPD was insisting that we give it back to them, because the Daniels settlement had expired, so you're like, you don't need it anymore. And we were like, that's ridiculous. We're filing a case about stop and frisk. Like, why would the stop and frisk data not be relevant? So we had to go file an order to show cause to be able to hold on to the data until Judge Shinlin could decide whether or not we were entitled to it, because the NYPD was literally making an argument that we were not entitled to the data anymore. So I remember going up to her chambers and sitting there, and her clerk came out and got the motion papers and went in and came back out and she signed it and we left. But I say all that to say that, you know, in some ways people are like, oh, you're an OG, you litigated this case from the beginning. I'm like, yes, but I'm not really an OG. The OGs are people like Jihyun, and OG in a good way, and the folks who really have been working, not in terms of age, in terms of experience and knowledge, the folks who've been working on these issues for decades and really, as we're going to talk about, really informed, you know, not only we ended up asking for, but really our strategy and the framing of the case, which is so important. You know, I think there was a lot of folks who, when we first filed the case, were like, why are you bringing a race claim? You're never going to win it. And I'm like, because that's what this case is about. Like, that's the truth. I came in at the beginning of the Floyd litigation, but in terms of this story and the struggle, I kind of came in midstream and then stuck with it for about, 13 years.
You're still in it.
Yeah, and still in it, as maybe we'll talk about later, too.
I think we will talk about it later. So this is a great moment to sort of think a little bit more deeply about the evolution of this particular strategy. I think we've gotten that sort of history of this struggle. This is a long struggle. those of you who are in the struggle now, you are standing on the shoulders of giants, of people who've committed their lives to ending racist policing, to imagining a world beyond policing. But there's particular moments of decision that we want to talk about in terms of the evolution of this strategy from Daniels, the settlement, through to Floyd. And so I wonder, David, if you can share a little bit about your decision to join the case. Well, so maybe actually, Juhian, if you could say a little bit first about the conversation with Richie and with Cappy and others to say, like, you know what, let us go to CCR or to whoever we think might be willing to take this on. And then, David, I would love to ask you to follow up with your own decision to join.
Sure. So I think I want to situate a little bit historically. Before Daniels was filed. So in 1997, Abner Louima was raped by NYPD officer Justin Volpe. And there was significant protest around that in terms of trying to get the cops fired, et cetera, et cetera. The CAPI groups were part of that, doing direct action, civil disobedience. When Amadou Diallo, and so were the families of folks like the mother of Anthony Baez, the mother of Anthony Rosario, the aunt of Hilton Vega, the mom of Yongxin Huang. Anyway, there's a number of families whose loved ones had been killed by the NYPD who were actually building their own part of the movement at the time. And so I want to situate that because it's also during, how many of you have heard of this guy named Rudy Giuliani? So he was the fucking mayor. Oh, sorry. He was the mayor. He was the mayor and really built up what we now understand as broken windows policing. So this whole paradigm of broken windows policing and the kind of racist destruction that it brings. And I'm going back to that period because after Amadou Diallo was murdered in February of 1999, part of what the CAPI groups decided to do was really try to plan around the year 2000 because we knew that court cases would come up around Diallo and around Louima in 2000, and that was an opportunity to really try to galvanize the city to really protest and resist racist policing and police violence in general. And so that is actually around the time when Richie came to us, and again, all of us were actually much younger than him for the most part, and one of the things he trained us in, I think, was to really have an understanding that we have to use any and all tactics. Mm-hmm. So in his day job, he was working at a spot called Community Service Society and running voter registration, civic engagement work, other public policy. And while a number of us were really steeped in direct action, he was like, look, direct action is great, it's not going to get all of it. So, and there's no reason for us to not use these other tactics. So for some of us, including me, this was kind of my first introduction into what a legal strategy might be. And so he was like, so we're going to do this. There's people amongst your memberships who can be part of the litigation. And then most of that, the litigation work and planning around Daniels happened with CCR after that.
Awesome. And so then as we think about kind of building, as Juhian is saying, thinking about who is in the community and what Behed was saying, that this is a different kind for those who are interested in impact litigation and the kind of work that CCR does, which is about movement lawyering, right? Like, how are we building power with this particular intervention? And it's not about the perfect plaintiff. It's about the true plaintiff and the one who also can be part of this movement that we're building. So wondering about your decision at that time, if you can take us back to join this case.
Yeah, I grew up in New York City, right? The first time I was beat by the police, well, I was 15. My father was there. And so that, to me, has been a continually occurring, maybe not to that same level of violence since up until forever, and will be for the rest of my life. But by the time I was 19 or 18, whenever I signed up for Floyd and I was in college, I was going to St. John's at the time. And it was at the first, you know, one of three stops I testified to, the first two being in this area where I was living in Queens. And immediately after, and I don't want to spend so much time eating up, and, you know, I can at some point exactly how this first stop happens. But at the end of it, I called my parents and crying and just the weight of this just continually happening was a lot. And, you know, I know my mom saw an article and reached out to the person who had written the article, and they pointed her into the direction of CCR. And it's crazy to say, like, now I'm 35. Like, I was stopped and frisked, and I sued the cops again in 2018 while I was an attorney when I left work. Right. I didn't have the understanding of the continuous effect of this back then, but by then I was pretty upset that it was still happening to me. And so I was all in. The way I looked at it was, what was the worst they could do to me? You know? I mean, I guess continue doing what they were already going to do. So my mom reached out to CCR. They wanted to speak to me. At this time, there were two stops that I was talking to them about, both in Queens, both within like 100 feet of where I was staying in that area, Hillside. And so then I came and I remember I told them the two incidents that happened. And from that moment, they asked me to join on. I signed on, and I was all in, and still all in. You know, I personal skin in the game and shit. And so that's how I ended up on.
Thank you for sharing that. Part of what we'll talk about too is how painful sometimes it is that we have these victories, quote unquote, and the harm continues. And so, what does that mean? And how do we adjust and keep protecting our people as the systems and structures continue to persist? Darius, just on this point, you know, as you're working with community, communities coming to CCR, just thinking about the role of the lawyer, and then what else needed to be done? As you were, you know, you came in 2 weeks before we were going to file. Mm-hmm. Maybe just talk a little bit about what was left undone by Daniels, why now, why this? And then what is the role of the lawyer in this particular moment?
So I guess starting with the second question, Daniels and what was left undone. Daniels was a really important case. I mean, without Daniels, there wouldn't have been a Floyd. And, you know, I think from a strictly legal perspective for us as lawyers, the part of Daniels that was the most important for us was obviously having access to that data, because that was part of the settlement. With that data, we were able to kind of build the Floyd case. I mean, it's really, you know, what I like to tell people about Floyd and lawyers about it, that I think, you know, in terms of like how we built the case, it's a really great example of how you really have to use both data, statistics, like that kind of stuff, and then obviously the stories of people's experiences. And so without, you know, we needed both of those things. And without either of them, we couldn't have done what we did. And so that's a really important part about Daniels. I think the other really important piece of Daniels for us as lawyers, and more of a lesson I think we learned, is that, and we're going to talk more about this later, is for the movement, what was most important to them was really remedy, right? How are things going to change? You know, obviously we have to prove the constitutional violation first, and that's something we as lawyers, I think we're trained to do, we feel comfortable doing. But then when it comes to the point of like, okay, you've proven this constitutional violation, you've proven how what the NYPD is currently doing is unconstitutional, illegal, discriminatory, how do you fix it? That's where I think, and this is true, I think, of impact litigation generally, that's where things get a little bit harder to do. And so Daniels was a settlement that, you know, had a lot of really good things in it, but it was in some ways inherently limited. And I think one of the reasons that was is because when it came time to settle the case, as Bahar alluded to earlier in 2003, you know, I think there was a lot of fatigue. I think there was a lot of, you know, because the case had been going on for 4 years. I think, you know, it's really resource and time intensive to litigate those kinds of cases. And at that point, I think the movement was not as, I think, robust as it was a few years before that, and then as it became a few years after that. And so what you ended up having is a situation where it was kind of a fairly traditional settlement that you see in civil rights litigation, where you have a bunch of lawyers around a table and they come up with what's essentially a contract, and it has terms in it. And, you know, there are provisions about like how to enforce the terms. And then you move on. And so, you know, the terms of that settlement were I wouldn't object to any of them. They were all things that I support, but I think they obviously didn't go far enough, because then when it came fast forward 4 or 5 years and the settlement term is expiring, the problem that the settlement was supposed to address, which is unconstitutional, racially discriminatory stop and frisk, had really in many ways gotten worse, as the data had told us. And so, very long, windy way of answering your question, I think, you know, when we then start Floyd, I think we very early on in the case, the lawyers were thinking about, okay, we obviously have to really work closely with the movement folks, the folks on the ground, to develop and think about, like, what do we want, right? It's not just an end to, obviously we want an end to unconstitutional stop and frisk, but how do we make that happen? And what specifically can we ask the court to do or to order to get us there? Obviously, we're going to have to prove the constitutional violation first, which I think, as I said, as lawyers, we were thinking a lot about how we're going to do that. But then what do we want? And so, you know, we, I feel like, started having those conversations, if I remember correctly. Yes, I mean, on the eve of trial, but I feel like even a couple years before that, I think we started having those conversations. So I think that was really one of the biggest lessons we learned.
Thank you so much. We're going to now kind of move into that moment of the trial, if we can, because I think CCR is also a proud member of CPR, Communities United for Police Reform, and I took over Darius's role as a member of the steering committee when you left. And so we were talking about 10 years since Floyd, and everyone was like, oh, damn, 10 years. And people would immediately go back into these 9 weeks of the trial. They were like, oh, this 9 weeks. I wasn't there, so I've heard this as folklore and want us all to feel it if we can. So this is open to everyone in part, and then we can kind of move into a little bit of the kind of pack the court strategy that was part of it. But I wonder if you can maybe, Juhian, tell us a bit about those sort of 9 weeks of the trial. And then, David, I'll ask, like, if there's a powerful moment that you remember that you would want to share, which is just really, I think what you'll hear is just the power of community in this moment. Like, it's different, right? Law in the hands of community and of organizers is different. It's electric. It matters in a different way. So anyway, I just want to be there. I wish I was there. I kind of feel like I was there a little bit from the stories I've heard, but 9 weeks of trial, some of the most powerful moments, and just a bit of the strategy behind those weeks would be awesome, Juhian.
So I think that I should probably situate the trial in CPR's overall strategy at the time. CPR was publicly launched in 2012. In the first week that we launched, we were blessed with a New York Post editorial basically saying, right, accusing groups within of doing terrible things, whatever. And that was within the first week. We thought it would take about 6 months before the Post actually did it. Nope. So we thought that was a badge of honor, or some of us did. Some people were actually very concerned, and some actual member organizations almost left because they're like, what is this new thing we just joined, and we're now getting really bad press attention. But they stayed. So I'll say that. But the overall strategy was to see if we could actually align a broad cross-sector of groups that are racial justice groups, groups that were fighting police violence, civil libertarian groups, other groups in New York City, to really try to tackle the problem of policing in some concrete way and make some agreements that we will try to move a certain set of objectives together. So this was actually a total experiment. When I got hired, I thought that the coalition would last for 1 to 2 years max. Apparently, it still goes on. But the reason I thought that it would only last for 1 or 2 years and still thought it was a good idea to take a job, even though I was an acupuncturist at the time, was because it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, I thought, to try to see if we could get these legal organizations, big and small, working with most militant left grassroots organizations and some of the community-based organizations that were maybe more middle-aligned, communications groups, others, and see if we could actually do a broad tent strategy to really move something in a very concrete way. And I thought it was an experiment that was worth trying. A few weeks before, maybe 2 months before the trial, I think Darius came. Oh, sorry. And so the rest of the strategy, though, was not only around Floyd. There was a legislative package called the Community Safety Act at the time. There was there were specific community-based work, including cop watch patrols and teams that were being built up around the city. There was cultural work, including murals, Know Your Rights murals, cop watch murals across the city. There was strategic communications and just plain old organizing in communities and political education in communities. So Floyd was one of the litigations that were happening around that time or were being filed around that time. Two others that are worth noting because they relate to Stop and Frisk were Davis, which was around stops in and around public housing that the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, as well as Legal Aid Society, brought. Then there was Ligon, which was around private buildings, stops in and outside, that included Bronx Defenders and the New York Civil Liberties Union. And one story I will tell you quickly about Ligon is that also came directly from community. The idea for Ligon came from a workshop that a staffer, a non-lawyer staffer from the NYCLU, went to Picture the Homeless, which was organizing unhoused people. And one of the issues that came up were these stops in private buildings. And that advocacy person brought that back to her legal team, and they decided to bring litigation. So I want to just kind of emphasize that, because a lot of times we don't hear the backstory of why some of this comes together. So Floyd was happening around the same time as we were also trying to get these Community Safety Act bills passed, and all this other stuff was happening. A few months before Floyd started, I remember a meeting that some of us from CPR had with Darius and probably Sunita Patel, who was also one of the attorneys at CCR working on this case. And I think we asked, so Darius, how many weeks will we have to pack the court? And he was like, you know, I think it's going to be 2 or 3 weeks. We're like, cool. We can do that. No problem. We'll get groups from across the city, because at that point we had grown the coalition around the Community Safety Act to 100 plus groups. We can get groups across the city to do different pieces, because from our perspective, legal cases were important, but it didn't go back to community. The only people who cared about it was whoever read the legal pieces in the news or what have you, or heard about it on NPR or whatever, but it's very, very isolated. And so it was really important to us to make this very community-driven. So every day the courtroom was packed. We also had an overflow court. It actually went for almost 10 weeks. And no, it's all right.
9.5 weeks.
Believe me, I remember. And I can't tell you what happened in the courtroom. I'm not convinced I was actually ever in the courtroom, but all of our members, or many of our member organizations were. There were press conferences pretty much daily outside, whether it's directly outside the courtroom or in communities. Youth organizations from across the city, like Brotherhood Sister Soul in Harlem, Make the Road New York's youth program in Bushwick, El Puente also in Bushwick, all of them were mobilizing their young people around this, educating them about this. There were faith leaders who were doing press conferences. So part of this was an inside-outside strategy in terms of the courtroom of making sure that we had community members in the courtroom to make clear to the NYPD and to the judge that this wasn't just going to be some court case isolated in a courtroom. But secondly, that we had a strong strategic communications effort, too, that was running parallel with these outside press conferences as well as in-community teach-ins that were happening in communities and neighborhoods across the city. So that's part of what I remember. But mostly what I remember is Darius lying to me.
What?
About it being 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
Go ahead.
I was just going to just add this. It's related, but, you know, so Joo-Hyun keeps mentioning the Community Safety Act, so I want to also acknowledge this is the 10-year anniversary of that passing, which was, I think, the week after the Floyd Chinlin's decision was the override of the veto vote, because I remember it being very dramatic. It was like a late night in city council, and they had to get 3/4.
Well, the late night was in June.
Oh, I think there was another late night in August.
The later in the day, in August, so in June, there was a vote that was after midnight in the city council.
Yeah.
A vote in the city council that was after midnight, and then in July, when I was on vacation, Mayor Bloomberg vetoed it.
Yeah.
And then in August, the city council overrode the veto. And that was a little bit nuts. So it was right around the time of the veto. Okay.
And the reason this is so important is because the Community Safety Act is directly related to the very issues we're talking about today. Community Safety Act included the bias policing statute for the city of New York, which is one of, if not the broadest in the country. It protects not just it prohibits not just profiling on the basis of race, but, you know, gender, religion, sexual orientation, age, housing status, immigration status. So that was part of that. And then the other thing, it's not the 10th year anniversary, but we should also acknowledge, because CPR really made this happen, is the Right to Know Act, which many of you also are all familiar with, is really a direct result of the work that they did, which is another hugely important bill that's related to this, because it talks about what police officers have to, what information they have to give people when they stop them, when they search them, and that's hugely critical to folks in terms of knowing what their rights are during these encounters. But then the other thing I'll say is, yes, I did lie to Joo-Hyun about the trial. But lying, you have to, like, knowingly lie. I had no idea. I had never done a trial this big either. I think this was maybe at that point my second federal trial, and the one I had done before in my prior job had been a week or two, but that was not a huge class action case, so I grossly underestimated how long it would take. But the last thing I'll say is, from my perspective, like, having those folks in the courtroom every day, like, behind us, like, having the people that we were representing behind us every day for 9 weeks was, like, an incredible thing. And I think definitely re-energized us, because 9 weeks is a long time to go to the same courtroom every day. And not every witness is the most interesting witness, you know, to listen to. They're all important. And so having those folks there every day was, like, an incredible thing. And I mean, such a rare thing to have. Because it's one thing to come out for the opening arguments and to come out for the closing arguments, but to be there every single day for, like, you know, more than 2 months is just an incredible thing.
Thank you. David, do you have a moment that you would want to share?
Yeah, I remember I went every day that I could to court to watch what was going on, even before I ended up testifying, which I think was later in the nine-week process. The first day I went, I didn't get into the main courtroom because it was overfull, and I went to the breakout courtroom where they had monitors, and that was completely full. I had a stand in the back. And I remember telling Darius, like, I couldn't get in. He was like, wait a minute, you're part of this case. You could have walked in with us. I was like, oh, all right. And then I started doing that. you know, it's interesting being a lawyer now and have done 7 or so trials in the state court. And it's weird looking back at what that experience was like. I would say it was a mix of funny, pride, anger, sadness. And those feelings for me were in the span of an hour, in the span of day to day, to know the truth, to know what happened to you, and to see it being spoken in a courtroom. It was very powerful. Mm-hmm. And there are moments that are comical, like being accused of being in 3 different gangs at the same time. The cross-examination of Orange versus Ginger. I identified a police officer in one of the 3 stops in the deposition, I identified him as a ginger colored haired person. I could have said that better.
That works.
And it just didn't flow. You know, it's all about flow. And then on the stand, when I identified the police officer, I said Orange. And the city's lawyers just pounced on it with, well, back then you said, and Judge Shinlin said, well, no, that's the same thing, move on. And I think that was the end of, the cross-examination. But that was being on the stand in federal court. It's an experience. There is anxiety and all that stuff. But I can tell you how I felt was that I knew what had happened to me. There was nothing that the people's lawyers would be able to say to me about these events, because they were true. And they were true to the way that I testified to them, because that's what had happened. And I felt safe up there. I felt that what I had to say was important, and that was something that I wasn't prepared for, because I had no faith. I had no faith in the system. None. I had no faith. And those experiences in court through the whole thing and the incredible team that made this a reality, that's why I became a fucking lawyer. Mm-hmm. And that's why I dedicated my legal career to public defense.
David, thank you so much for bringing your whole self into this work, into this moment, moment.
I don't know how to not do that. Unfortunately.
This is why you're the best.
Sorry.
Funny, angry, sad, prideful, hearing your truth be validated. There's something powerful about it. The system, you're right not to have faith in the system as well. The system is not designed for our safety. The system is not designed to protect and promote the rights of our communities. And yet we use it. I think it's great, Juhian, that you brought Malcolm into this room, you brought through Richie, like, use any means necessary. And that's part of what this story is about too, like, using all of the means, every tactic that we have, but rooted in community, rooted in the lived experiences of people who can speak to this, So I have three more questions and would love if folks have questions to be thinking about them now. I think it's coming up on the chat too. There's lawyers, there's law students, there are people who are going to be watching this, who are going to be seeing also Abby's art and thinking about the lessons learned. So we want to extract some of those, but I want to stop for a bit so that we don't miss it because it's coming up, which is around remedy. Darius, you touched on it a little bit too. You've already attended a little bit of the School of Juhyun this morning, but Beh had also talked about the sort of co-creation of the remedy with community, the butcher board. What is it that we want? Not what are we going to concede to, what's the bare minimum, what's possible, but what do we want? So I want us to just pause for a little bit to speak about remedy as a lesson learned, but also just how that happened, the sort of co-creation of the remedy, what you remember from it, just so that we can hold it. Because I think there's also lessons learned there too, I'm sure, in terms of how big we can go. But Darius, Juhyun, if you want to tag team this around remedy.
Sure. I mean, I'll go first and be sort of brief. Kind of like I said earlier, I think the lessons learned from Daniels and really the lessons I took from just reading about a lot of impact litigation, civil rights cases throughout law school and then early in my legal career, it really for me was crystallized like we don't think enough about what the remedy is going to be. I mean, obviously proving the constitutional or statutory violation is very hard and you have to work really hard to make that happen, and it's so rare to win. I mean, maybe this is a function of the fact it's rare to win these cases in court, but I was like, I'm litigating this case, and the movement wants us to litigate this case because they want to see actual change. I mean, yes, we care about setting a great precedent, and obviously the decision is a joy to read, and much props to Her Honor, who's sitting back there. It's one of the greatest pieces of legal writing I've ever read, and I know my team would agree. A lot of them, I've forced them to read it. But not forced them. I asked them to read it, and I think they enjoyed it. But for me, like, it was really important that, like, we get this right, because we're not going to have another crack at this. Like, and I think, you know, we are really in a great place. We you know, the confluence of forces. We have an incredible movement that's active in the city, that's engaged in this case. You know, we have a great team of lawyers. We were very lucky to have a judge who cared about these issues and really understood them. And so we were really in a great place. So, like, this is our chance. And so we got to get it right. We mean, we're going to go to trial. Hopefully we can win. And then we have to really be very thoughtful and intentional about what we're asking for. And so I think it became clear to myself and the other folks on the legal team, Sunita, Bahar, co-counsel at Bell Doc, shout out John Moore and his team, Ian, that, like, we needed to sit down with our partners and have several conversations about this. And so we really, I think, leaned on Juhyun and CPR and the groups to be like, okay, how should we have this conversation? How should we structure it? The other thing I'll say is I think we did want to bring some folks in from Cincinnati, and the reason we chose Cincinnati is they, I think about 10 years before us, about 10 years? Yeah, early 2000s. So yeah, they were kind of going through similar litigation around very similar issues in the city of Cincinnati. There have been, I think, a series of killings of unarmed black men by the Cincinnati police, as well as just a lot of pedestrian and traffic stops of black people in black neighborhoods in Cincinnati. And litigation came out of that. There was a DOJ investigation, but there was also like a class action lawsuit brought by a group called the Black United Front in Cincinnati, and they worked with the ACLU of Ohio. And the reason that case really stood out to us is that instead of kind of going the traditional way of either litigating to trial or doing kind of a standard settlement like we talked about earlier, they thought the most effective way to deal with the problem and to get like a lasting, meaningful remedy was to do a process that would really bring in all of the relevant stakeholders on these issues, and in a very structured way with a team to facilitate the process, come up with like a series of basically remedies that they could then present to the court in as kind of like a consent decree, and then the court would ended up signing off on that. And so we brought in a lot of the folks that were involved in that process. We brought in Iris Rowley from the Black United Front. We brought in Alphonse Gerhardstein, who was the ACLU lawyer at the time. And we I think we even brought in some of the members of the Cincinnati Police Department who were actually invested in the process, in very stark contrast to the NYPD's attitude at that time about the case. Cincinnati Police Department and some of their police unions actually got involved in this process of community engagement. So we brought those folks in to meet with a lot of the CPR groups and the Floyd legal team. But in terms of like how we structured that conversation, you should talk about that because I feel like you guys made that happen.
So let me just go backwards a little bit again. One thing I just wanted to mention about the timing of the period when the trial happened is that part of what our analysis was at CPR, and by CPR I mean all the groups, not me, not the staff, CPR, was that we needed to really frame what was happening in New York in terms of stop and frisk abuses in a national frame. And the way we understood it was that it was a national human rights crisis, that the number of stops, especially of young black men, one of the years actually was documented as the number of stops of young black men. There were more stops than the number of young black men who lived in New York City by census. And so kind of the daily crisis is what we were trying to actually help make sure that was exposed, because that was one example. The reason I say that is because the one day I remember being at part of the trial was probably the first day. And we walked out in the middle of the day to do, I think, a press conference and a rally. And what I remember was young people from El Puente had brought signs that they created beautiful, beautiful art. And the Reverend Jesse Jackson also came, which we did not expect. And when he was like, I want to speak, we're like, I mean, I guess, of course. What would he say? Thank you, and of course, are you again? But I'm saying that more just to kind of situate that the strategy was to try to make this a national issue. And some of that was because of the lessons of Daniels. Daniels wasn't just inadequate because the reforms weren't enough. It was also inadequate because we didn't have community power to enforce that the reforms would even happen. And that's another thing that we saw again in Floyd. But going back to the, I actually remember the remedies conversation differently. I remember the Cincinnati meeting. I don't think that most of the grassroots groups in CPR saw the Cincinnati meeting as the pivotal place where we understood remedies. What we understood was when you and Sunita came to us and was like, you know, we can do something creative here. We can ask the judge to have a process where community members could actually have a real voice in identifying what remedies would be needed. That's what we were most interested in, which became the joint remedies process. Now, the joint remedies process, I don't know that I would necessarily say ended up being a success, but that's partially because we believe, actually, that if Judge Shindlin had still been the judge and had not been kicked off because of the bullshit that Bloomberg, et cetera, did, that we would be in a different place right now. But when the judge changed, the monitor at the time, the late Peter Zimroth, had enormous power that was unchecked. And he completely disregarded the perspectives of community organizations. So regardless of what happened, and completely disregarded the joint remedies process recommendations. So the process of developing the ideas of remedies actually took place mostly during the joint remedies process for us, by going into communities, holding organizing meetings with folks in different neighborhoods to identify what they wanted to do. The very first one was held by DRUM, a group in Desi's Rising Up and Moving in Jackson Heights with South Asian communities in Jackson Heights. And so kind of naming a little bit of that because it was an ongoing evolutionary process. But one of the worst things that happened, in addition to Judge Shindlin being kicked off the case, was that there was a gap of about a year plus where there was a stay. So the ruling comes down in August of 2013. We don't actually start anything until late 2014. And that was actually incredibly devastating in terms of momentum that was lost. But also, if you remember, the national situation at that point is that Mike Brown had been murdered, Eric Garner had been murdered, Tamir Rice had been murdered. So there is a national understanding, which we thought in 2014, many of us across the country thought it was going to be a once-in-a-generation lifetime understanding, kind of like what happened when Rodney King was brutalized, that policing was a problem. So people were really looking at the lens of police murder at that point, which made it much harder to mobilize people around the daily encounters. And I just want to name that because the reality of power has to be taken into account when we think about any litigation success or not success. And it's not just about what happens in the courtroom and the validity of your legal argument. It's really about whether or not we can build and sustain community power.
That's amazing. It's really about whether we can build and sustain community power. CCR has a saying that around success without victory, right? That there's something more than the victory. even though there is a victory to celebrate here. But often there is. There's something else. Like, and I think as lawyers, as law students, as community organizers, thinking about that is an exciting way to orient ourselves. I have two more questions. One is about the definition of victory. And David, I'm curious for you to respond a little bit about how you might define victory in this particular moment, in this movement, in part because, as you were saying, like, stop and frisk has evolved. Stop and frisk continues in different ways. So what does that mean? And then I think we're going to move into the last question, and then if you all have some questions, that'll be great.
Yeah, it's interesting. Because it depends on where I was in the last 10 years, I could have answered this differently. I think I'm going to focus on the victory that came out of this case, which was that the policing of Terry stops as done by the New York City Police Department was unconstitutional and illegal. That's a victory. That, for that to be recognized in court, is a victory. There were more stops at one point than people to be stopped, right? Which means multiple stops per person. We went from 300,000 stops to 10,000, 50,000.
Yeah, I don't know where they are right now. 20,000 reported. Documents.
Those are the exact numbers, which I don't believe they are, because I have no reason to believe that. These beliefs of what the NYPD does, it's based off of my own lived personal experiences growing up, and also like being an attorney that cross-examines and gets these documents from the NYPD. And the victory is that to go from 300,000 people to 25,000 people means there are 280,000 people or whatever that are not going through that experience. Mm-hmm. And that is something that as I get older, I appreciate more. It really wasn't until I got into law school that I realized that what was happening to me, like how my perspective, my reality was so fucked up and so skewed and so not normal. And when I say it, like, it wasn't, my experiences with police was not my peers' experience. It was not that is not what people, the majority of people go through, unfortunately. Majority of people of color, especially in inner cities, do. But the fact that there are less people that have to live with that trauma continuously, that's a big victory. And that's something that I think needs to be underscored. I'd love for it to be zero people. I don't know if that's a reality. I know it's not a reality if policing continues the way it does. I remember feeling that even after we won, that wasn't the end. For me, it was a battle, and that was won. And the war is long, and this is a seven-headed beast. And just because one head is chopped off or injured doesn't mean it can't keep fighting, and we should have to stop fighting. And so it was victory. It should be celebrated, and it was, and it was good. And we have a lot more victories to go, because there should be no kids growing up in this city or any city in America or the world that has to have these type of police interactions. And there are too many.
Thank you, David. You're going to lead us also into the visioning session of this afternoon. Grateful for you. And yeah, let us pause to understand the victory and that this is just one. We're like continuing. This is called a struggle. You're part of a struggle and a movement for a reason. I want to, just before we get into this last question of just sort of the most encouraging outgrowth of this work and the trajectory that we're on, I just wonder if there are, kind of knowing what you know now to both Juhian and Darius, is there something you might change about a strategy or a tactic? I'm thinking particularly about the monitorship. Juhian, you spoke to it too, that there were forces outside of our control. This might look different if our political landscape was different and weren't so scared of movement victories. But is there anything that you might, just for us to keep in mind as we move forward into the next battle?
The one thing that I wish we had been more mindful of in 2013 after the ruling, and especially after the appellate court changed the judges, was making sure that we had a plan to resource community-based organizations to really be able to participate in a full way for the next several years. We had no idea that we would still be actually in the monitorship 10 years later, but at least for the next 3 to 4 years. Not doing that meant that it was incredibly challenging for groups like Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, the Justice Committee, Brotherhood Sister Soul, El Puente, Vocal New York, you know, tons of community organizations, Brooklyn NAACP, Drum, et cetera, to be able to participate in a meaningful way in the remedies process and in the monitoring of the remedies process. And that it's not enough to just have a legal organization do that. And that's not dissing CCR, who I love and who I have tremendous respect for, but there are different roles to play. And the fact that that role was unresourced meant that it guaranteed that there would be less continued community input in a meaningful way.
I mean, I was actually going to say something a little similar to that, because I think, or what you said, I think, is part of my answer, which is that even though we did, I think, put a lot of thought into remedy, at least before there was a remedy, like what we should ask for, I don't think we really thought enough about how are we going to make this happen. And a big part of that was like, look, if we're expecting these community groups to show up and engage with this process day after day, year after year, they need to be resourced, right? We need to have a system in place where, like, we are making sure, like, in a structured way, they're coming in and we're able. And, like, a lot of it became a little bit haphazard once the monitorship started. I mean, I think a lot of that's on us. I'm looking at some of my team members. So it's hard, right? Because I think if after the judgment came out had gone differently, in other words, if there wasn't an immediate appeal and a stay and the judge being removed from the case and a new mayor coming in and us trying to urge the mayor to drop the case, if we had some time to kind of pause and be like, okay, we have this process now, let's sit down and strategize, what do we need, what resources, it might have gone differently. And I'm not saying that as an excuse, but I think the way it ended up playing out is we were just continued to put out fires for like another year at least. And so then when it came time, it's like, okay, we're going to start this process, we were caught a little bit off guard. So I think, I guess the big takeaway for me is, again, you have to put so much thought into not only what do you want, how are you going to then operationalize it and make it happen? And that's not just, you know, having a monitor, but it's how are you going to engage with that monitorship? How are you going to make sure that your community partners are able to engage with that monitorship and that their voices are going to be heard? How are you going to make sure they have the resources to do that? What systems do you have to put into place to make sure that this process, this joint remedial process, which again, I think on paper looked great, like how are you going to make sure that in practice it actually does what it was designed to do? And again, that's not something that lawyers are typically doing, or typically asked to do, or typically thinking about. But I think it's something we, again, if we really want to, and I don't use the term lightly, be movement lawyers in this context, in this impact litigation context, you really have to put the thought into all of that stuff.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Activist Files, the Center for Constitutional Rights podcast. Just a reminder to subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Spotify, and SoundCloud. And if you want to find out more about our work, visit our website at ccrjustice.org. That's all until next time on the Activist Files.